Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the sound. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, we're opening our show this morning replaying a fall 2015 segment welcoming an outreach specialist representing Connecticut's vet centers. We'll discuss the range of services provided to combat veterans and other programs to help support our heroes and their families 365 days a year across the state. Then we'll turn the focus to helping you or an aging loved one you know age in place. February is National Senior Independence Month, so we'll chat with a former trauma nurse who runs an agency featuring a range of services and new technological solutions that can promote safety and independence for seniors economically. And we'll wrap with Connecticut's Department of Housing Commissioner touting a $54 million grant package the state just received that's going to be used to improve shoreline infrastructure and increase resiliency to combat future weather events as communities continue to recover from Superstorm Sandy. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this news. Coming up on March 12th, Lady Star Cleaning is hosting a fundraiser to benefit the Tommy Fund for Childhood Cancer through the Academy of Kempo's Help a Child initiative. The event's coming to Odie's Place on Whitney Avenue in Hamden with children's events from 1 to 3 featuring magic and balloon animals, music, and pizza, along with soft drinks. Then adult events start from 3 to 6, featuring comedians along with live music by Headspace and Tim Webster, admissions by donation at the door, and there'll be raffles and a silent auction. To learn more, contact organizers Mark and Cheryl Peckham of Lady Star Cleaning at 203-589-9950. This is a benefit for Tommy Fund for Childhood Cancer. Well, I came across a brand new friend a few months ago and said, why don't you guys come out on the radio program? And Gabe Kautzner has taken us up on that. And it is only appropriate as we head into this very special week with Veterans Day smack dab in the middle of it, Wednesday. Gabe Kautzner is here. He is an RCS1 counseling technician and outreach specialist with the Veterans Administration's Vet Centers. And we're here today to both introduce this area of veteran support for the very first time on the award-winning For the People, and also to give some background, a little bit of who they are, what they do, some of the services that are offered, and some of the things that Gabe and his associates with Vet Centers can do for you. If you are a veteran, family member, perhaps you'll want to stick around and stay tuned for this interview. So, Gabe, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that.
And so folks may be also familiar with you from a public access television program that you do?
Yes, I do a public access TV show called Sandbox Chronicles. It's with CTV out of New Haven, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. It's on the government channel. I believe it's 97. I do it live. Actually, I'm going to do it live today, Thursday. It's 3 to 4. And then every third Monday, I do it 3 to 4 also in the afternoon.
Excellent. So some folks that may have seen the show may be a little bit familiar with what we're going to be talking about. Maybe there'll be some new news for them as well. So let's before we talk about the contact number, let's talk a little bit about the VA and how the vet centers are kind of one piece of that big VA puzzle.
Well, the Vet Centers was a program that was established by Congress in 1979, recognizing that a significant number of Vietnam veterans were still experiencing readjustment counseling problems. Vet Centers are community-based, and it's a storefront-type community outreach center, which mm-hmm. means it looks like a normal building that you just walk into. Nothing medical, very little contact. You feel very, very comfortable.
Sure.
Usually when you do go into the waiting room, there's other veterans which make them feel very comfortable.
Yeah.
But we service all combat veterans. It goes from World War II right up to the war that's going on right now.
Yeah.
Well, I shouldn't say it's a war. It's not a war where, you know, but...
Various military engagements. Yeah.
Right, right. Anybody that was in engagement or, you know, even prior. I mean, we worked with a Vietnam vet that actually finished, you know, retired from Sikorsky, stopped, and then the PTSD hit him. That's why they call it post-traumatic stress disorder.
And I guess it can come decades later.
Right, right, it can. Now, my part of it is I do all the benefits. I do, I actually go out and I do casework, education. I'm embedded in all the colleges, community colleges. OASIS's were established by the state of Connecticut so that veterans could go someplace where they could relax, talk with other veterans and feel at home while they're doing their homework and everything, and they help each other.
So once in a while, you're up in my hometown of Waterbury at the Naugatuck Valley Community College?
Yes, every Tuesday. Tuesday, I go up there. I spend about 4 hours, and then I do the same for Gateway Community College and then also for University of New Haven.
And now, do you have counterparts that serve your same outreach and counseling technician functions in, like, Hartford and out in Norwich and Eastern Connecticut?
Well, actually, what's great about the vet centers, the counselors themselves are also in their job description supposed to do outreach. The thing is they have to counsel also. So probably like 80% of it is counseling, seeing veterans one-on-one to help them and doing the case management.
Right. Yeah.
Mine is going out and spreading the word, trying to let people know that the vet center's there. The VA is there. They can be eligible for a lot of things that they don't even know. I mean, the one thing that I get from veterans the most is, I didn't know. Mm-hmm. I didn't know you had those services. Yeah. I didn't know I could do this.
Yeah, and our buddy Ted Obb says the same thing.
Right.
As he goes out there, it's kind of surprising and a little bit disappointing that the system doesn't do a better job at promoting itself.
Right,
and that to so many veterans are saying, I didn't know that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the one thing I can say to you, when I got deployed and I came back, I was up at Fort Drum, and they always do what they call a TAPS program. It's a transitional assistance program, and all different people come up to talk about it. You know, the Veterans Administration, and there's, you know, state. There's other entities that talk about all kinds of different benefits,
stuff.
Right?
Yep.
Problem is most of the men and women are fed up. They want to go home.
Yeah, right.
they don't want to listen.
It's kind of like the last day of school.
Exactly.
Right, sure.
And that's one of the reasons they established the Yellow Ribbon program for a lot of the states is because when these men and women come back, they do a demobilization, then they do a 30, 60, 90, and 120 a day review with them.
Okay.
And some of those are with their families, because one of the things the vet center does that the VA does not is we can actually counsel with the families. We actually have a licensed family therapist in every single vet center in the United States, and also in Connecticut, which we have one in Danbury, Hartford, Norwich, and also us, which is in New Haven.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say earlier, as you were talking about it, the cool thing about the vet centers that's different from something like the VA hospital is, you said they're very inconspicuous. And I think maybe what is a barrier to a certain segment of veterans is even giving the impression that they're either asking for or may have realized they need help. So going to somewhere with like bright, kind of like the equivalent of bright flashing lights, pointing arrows at them saying, here comes another one for help. They come to these really kind of low-key, inconspicuous, and very welcoming vet centers, and it helps them maybe shed that stigma feeling or shed that fear, and that's what is kind of appealing to me as a non-veteran is the idea that even the environment of the vet centers is encouraging them to get the services so they don't have to keep asking, saying I didn't know that. So the other service that you guys offer is a toll-free number that anyone can call?
That is correct. It's 1-877-WAR-VETS or 1-877-927-8387. And it's an around-the-clock confidential call center where the combat veterans and their families can call to talk about military experience or other issues that are facing in a readjustment to civilian life. But this is the difference. The staff is comprised of combat veterans from several eras, as well as family members of combat veterans. And what's great is the service is completely free for combat veterans and their families. So they might find these resources they need at their nearest vet center.
And perhaps even with service peers from their own era of service.
Correct.
Yeah.
And the vet centers, they offer this wide range of services to veterans and their families in basically about 300 community-based vet center locations. Vet centers are across the U.S. and surrounding territories, including the U.S. Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Americas Samoa.
Great.
So we're out there.
Super. Gabe Kautzner is with us. If you're just joining us this morning, we're celebrating and honoring veterans this Veterans Day coming up this week and opening the program with this important introduction, at least as far as our For the People goes, of vet centers here in Connecticut. Gabe is an RCS1 counseling technician and outreach specialist with the VA Vet Centers. And what I've got in my hand here is like three pages of veterans who are eligible for vet center services. So probably is an easier question to answer. Is there any person who is alive who has served in the armed services or the war on terror who is not eligible for VA vet center services?
Well, most of the time, those that are non-combat are not eligible. We don't turn them away. We never turn away a veteran.
Right.
I mean, we will help them. We'll get them connected
sure. To
get services. One of the things that we run into, they lose their DD-214, which is their separation paper. We help them get that, and
then
we're able to help them. But what makes a difference for you to be a combat veteran, it has to be on the DD-214, that it's an imminent danger area. You were in an imminent danger area.
Okay.
And then there's a couple of other little things that can be on there. It could be the Global War on Terror's Expeditionary Medal.
Yeah.
There's some other things.
But folks could call that 877-WAR-VETS number and determine immediately what level of service they might be qualified for.
And they also could go on to www.vetcenter.va.gov.
/. Plenty of places that they can go before they even get started.
Right.
In the last 5 or 6 minutes that we have with you, Gabe, let's transition to this wide range of services available, starting out with bereavement counseling, which we'll just briefly touch upon.
Mm-hmm. Well, bereavement counseling is offered to parents, siblings, spouses, and children of the armed forces who died in service of our country. Also, they are eligible are family members of reservists and National Guardsmen who die while on federally activated duty. What I mean by that is, yes, they're activated to go to war, but they also can be at AT, which is annual training, because, believe it or not, that's paid by the government, and they're activated by the government for 2 weeks once a year.
But they could be activated on base and not yet deployed and, sadly, maybe get killed in a motor vehicle accident or something,
right.
And those family members can get those services.
And the thing is the vet centers, they do bend the rules a little bit.
Sure.
It just depends on what the situation is, because we're there for the veteran.
Right.
We're not going to look at it as black and white and turn somebody away.
You're going to do everything possible.
Everything
with
possible
everybody who calls.
That can be done.
Yeah.
We will do.
Great. One of the other things that we talk about on this program a lot, and that I see is supported and addressed by vet centers, is sexual trauma and harassment counseling. Let's get into a little bit of that element of service and support.
Well, it's funny because sexual trauma has been such a taboo in the military for such a long time. And veterans of both sexes, and I really mean this, both male and female, all eras, Vet Center services include individual readjustment counseling and also the referral of benefits assistance, group readjustment counseling, and also helping with the liaison for the community agencies. And our, of course, our family therapist who kind of works with the marital and family counseling and substance abuse information. I kind of help in the referral of job counseling and placement. And basically what it is it's sometimes it's very hard for people to really deal with it because it is a trauma. There's no doubt that it's a trauma. And that's what we're there to help with. Now, harassment counseling can almost be the same thing. You could be in the military and something happens and they're harassing you, and that might even lead to sexual trauma.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not really like a counselor.
Sure.
But that's about what it is from what I heard from them saying. So it's a very big thing.
And so this is all part. These are all part of the services that can be accessed through vet centers.
We have. We have a lot. We have a very good relationship with the VA Medical Center. Aaron Blatchley is the program manager for OEF, GWAT, Global War on Terrorism group. So I have a lot of connections.
Excellent. Before we wrap up, we want to remind people that aside from being able to call 877-WAR-VETS, that's 877-927-8387, they can also go to the website, and it's vetcenter.gov?
Right.
For any general information to determine eligibility for services or what services are offered and where vets or their loved ones can go to the centers here in Connecticut or anywhere within the sound of our voice, including some of the islands and territories of the United States. Lastly, before we go, Gabe, remind people that Vet Centers is not a 9-to-5 Monday through Friday thing.
Correct. Vet Centers are actually open from 8 to 4:30, but we have groups at nights, which the hospital, the VA Medical Center, sometimes cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have weekends. We can meet with the veterans on weekends if they are scheduled, and they can always call our office at 203-795-0148 and talk to Amy Radovoy to set up something where the veteran can come in. We also have a government car, and sometimes we go out to see the veteran. If they're immobilized and they can't really come to the vet center, we're willing to do that. And also, my outreach cell is 203-500-2129. I know this program, you're trying to put a lot of information into a little time, but if there's anybody out there that needs to call me and ask me a question, that would be great. Because the question you don't ask is the one that doesn't get answered. And I'm sure there's a lot of questions that veterans have.
Yes. As we indicated at the beginning of the program, one of the things you hear most frequently is that veterans didn't know that they were eligible for services. It's great to know that you, Gabe Kautzner, and the Connecticut Vet Centers stand ready along with their counterparts throughout the country and territories of the U.S. To serve and support veterans. Gabe Kautzner is an RCS1 counseling technician and outreach specialist here in Connecticut and working out of the greater New Haven area, and also hosting a public access television show on CTN, all tied to his work with Vet Center, Division of the Veterans Administration here. Once again, in honor of my late father, a World War II vet, and all the vets and families out there, past, present, and future, please rely on vet centers for their assistance. 877-WAR-VETS is the toll-free number. You can call from anywhere to find out about information, or vetcenter.gov. Gabe, thanks for being on the program. Well, whether you know it or not, February is National Senior Independence Month. So we have brought in an expert in the field to talk with us this morning about some important things, particularly how seniors can achieve permanent independence by creating a smart home. And we've got a smart guest to tell us all about it. Ron DeQuilla is a registered nurse. He's got 30 years of community health and management experience. He's the former director of emergency services at Mid-State Medical Center and has worked at Yale New Haven Hospital's Trauma Center. He's a Quinnipiac University and University of Hartford graduate, and he also has worked in and studied in economics and accounting. So we're going to call him our go-to guy on questions related to home care trends for those who want to be independent and age in place. So, Ron, thanks for being on the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So let's start by talking a little bit about, you know, kind of from 10,000 feet on independence and how the kind of exploding smart home initiative is really playing a huge role in probably making your job a lot easier.
Well, it is. And basically what we do is we have a home care agency here in Connecticut. We've been in business for 20 years, and we've taken care of, you know, thousands of seniors and individuals with disabilities over that time period. And over that time period, we've recognized that there have been issues with our folks that we take care of, such as falls, medication compliance, issues with wandering and social isolation and depression and so forth. And what we decided to do was start a company several years ago that goes along with our main company, which has technologies. And so the main company we have is for home care is Assisted Living Services, and we started a second company called Assisted Living Technologies back in 2010. And we have a variety of wireless sensor-based technologies that help us provide better care to our clients. And basically, that's what it's all about. So we've been putting and utilizing these technologies in people's homes, in group home settings, in assisted living facilities, all through Connecticut. And we've been very successful at helping to do things such as reduce falls and improve compliance with medications, so forth.
So you mentioned in a release that you mentioned the CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, the annual showcase of all the great hot new things in electronics, and really sort of not, I wouldn't say the birthplace, but the place where smart home technology was sort of first unveiled to the general public, and has been a venue for showcasing improvements in smart home technology. But also, on the other hand, you have worked on the front lines in trauma centers. So you've seen the results of, you know, sort of doing it wrong or not doing it right when it comes to trying to protect our aging neighbors, residents, and family members.
Well, that's true. And just the one factor that's a major issue that seniors deal with, which is falls. One in three individuals that are 65 or older will fall each year. And of that number, many will sustain very serious injuries, such as fractures or head injuries, requiring at least an ER visit, if not a hospitalization.
And then a substantial number of those people cannot really return home without substantial modifications or perhaps full-time medical or support assistance.
That's right. So our goal really is, while we have them at home and we're helping them age in place, we use some of these tools, such as wireless technologies, to help make sure or at least reduce the risk that an individual will fall.
Mm. So,
for example, we might have a caregiver in place that's doing eight-hour shifts with a client, and during the time in which they're there, we have sensors that help alert the caregiver that a client might be getting up. Or after hours, when the family's there with their loved one, it will alert them that this individual may be getting out of bed so they can help go and avert a fall.
Mm-hmm.
And so the wireless technology we use in that respect would be something like a bed sensor pad
mm-hmm.
and a wireless receiver that goes to wherever the caregiver might be to let them know somebody's about to get up or in the process of getting up.
Mm.
And that can help reduce the risk of a fall.
Yeah, and also I would imagine for people who are caring for loved ones with dementia, that not only could be an injury-preventing tool, but a life-saving tool because occasionally those folks get outside the house.
Sure. We do have sensors that can also go on exit doorways to alert a loved one or to alert a caregiver if somebody's about to leave that home so that they can help, stop the person.
Yeah. I guess it's all...
Yep.
Go ahead.
We have another example that we use, and this has been a great story. We have a woman that was discharged from a hospital that would forget to use her walker when she was getting up.
Mm.
And the physical therapist wanted to know, what can we do to remind her to use her walker when she gets up? And we actually have a sensor-based device that goes to a receiver. When she is about to get up, it actually reminds her in a recorded voice, use your walker. And she's been using her walker for over a year now without further falls. So it's just a nice way to cue people and to make sure that they do the things that will help them age in place safely.
Yes, because much like all of the folded laundry that's trying to find its way into drawers in my bedroom, it's nice to have a voice to remind us once in a while, because a lot of those
right.
things just fade into the woodwork when we're moving from point A to B. So
right.
that's great. Ron DeQuilla is with us. He is a co-founder of Assisted Living Technologies based in Meriden, right, Ron?
Yes, we have an office in Meriden, and we're also at the New England Assistive Technology Showroom, which is up in Hartford. We
mm-hmm.
have a display there of our various types of technologies
yep.
In that location as well.
Yep. And Ron brings a great and unique perspective to the issue as a registered nurse and former trauma center manager and nurse at a couple of Connecticut medical centers, which is an added benefit to all our listeners. And I guess, Ron, at this point, an important reminder that while you are a for-profit business owner, a lot of this technology is available on the open market. This is not exclusive technology to your company, and that, sometimes folks are listening on podcasts elsewhere in the country or beyond. This technology is universally accessible, right?
Oh, definitely.
Excellent.
You can go online and research and find some of these technologies. We do offer through our website a store in which people can go and actually buy these technologies, but you can also find them. Usually the manufacturers don't sell direct, but there are situations where you can purchase through other vendors any of these technologies. And they're not expensive. A lot of people
sure.
might be listening, hearing this as being somewhat expensive, but generally speaking, some of these wireless alert technologies are usually less than $75.
Oh, great. Well, we've got about 7 or 8 minutes left to talk and drill into some of these other technologies. Let's take a quick break and ask folks to stick with us here. We'll be back in just a few moments with Ron DeQuilla, RN, and co-founder of Assisted Living Technologies, to talk a little bit more about helping you age in place and remain independent safely. We'll be right back with Ron. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Coming up next Saturday, February 27th, the American Association of University Women's Connecticut Chapter is hosting its third annual Tech Savvy Conference from 8 to 4 at Trinity College in Hartford. The day-long event is designed to show girls firsthand how science, technology, engineering, and math fields can lead to exciting careers. You've heard about them. It's called STEM Careers. The conference will welcome more than 206 sixth to ninth grade girls, their parents, and teachers. You can register now for Tech Savvy coming up next Saturday in Hartford. Just click on aauw-ct.aauw.net. All right. Thanks for sticking with us. A lot of folks out there who are themselves or have loved ones who they want to see remain independent as long as possible. And for the many people who are realizing or who know the benefits of aging in place are back. And we thank you for that. As we mentioned, Ron DeQuilla is not only a registered nurse and former frontline trauma professional, but also founder of Assisted Living Technologies with offices in Meriden and a showroom in Hartford, where you could go and check out and look at some of this technology that we're talking about. So, Ron, in the earlier part of the show, we concentrated mostly on falls and that great device to help remind one of your clients to make sure she's using her walker whenever she gets up. But there are other sensor devices that that play other important roles. We talked about dementia related issues and just general forgetfulness, and we know from our statistics from another guest of ours on the Fire Protection Association that kitchen fires are one of, if not the major cause of household fires and fire deaths in the United States. And I see from the punch list here that you have got an answer for folks who might occasionally leave a pot burning on the stove.
Yes, we use a few different types of fire prevention type devices that can mount on a stove, primarily electric stoves, and they have sensors in them that as soon as the stove gets turned on, they will identify that there's an individual right near the stove cooking, because that's really the key, is to keep the individual around the stove. Mm. Safely around the stove. As soon as an individual leaves that area, a sensor times out the stove. It'll actually shut the stove off after a period of time, and the burners will go off and stop the risk of a fire starting. So that's one example. Another is a device, actually was just recently featured on Shark Tank, which was a device developed by a firefighter that as soon as there's smoke detected in the environment, it will automatically shut off the circuit to the stove. So we use a couple of different devices that help reduce the risk of stove fires.
That's great.
And they're sensor-based.
Yeah. The other growing area of intrigue for me is medication management. It's getting to the point where devices can take care of both the reminding and the dispensing that used to fall, for the most part, on the individual who needed to take the medication, and therein lies the rub, right?
Yes, this is a big issue with seniors and with our entire healthcare system, really, because basically there's avoidable healthcare costs, and one of the things that's most avoidable in the United States is the fact that if people would take their medications, the right medications at the right time, it could help really reduce healthcare costs. In fact, there's a study that shows that of individuals that are 65 years old or older that are on, you know, two or three medications a day, on average, they only take their meds about 50 to 60% of the time properly.
Wow.
So what we recommend and have in place that's been very successful is a device called MedMinder, which is a device that you set up with various compartments are available for all the medications to be placed by a loved one or by a nurse, and it's completely lockable. And so all the compartments lock except for the individual compartment where at the given time and day the medication is to be taken. And that begins to first blink, and then it beeps, at which point the individual can now take their medications. And if they do not take their medication, it actually sends information to a cloud-based server that can automatically call the house and tell the person to take their medication, or it can alert a loved one or a nurse that the medication's not being taken properly.
Wow, that's
so
excellent.
It's an outstanding device that really helps people. We have these throughout Connecticut and southern Massachusetts, and we're seeing with the individuals that we have these in place, they're actually taking their medication about 95% of the time, which is a huge improvement over the average.
Excellent.
And of course, if people take their meds, they're less likely to fall, they're less likely to develop other medical issues, and less likely to have to see their doctor so often or go to the hospital or an emergency room.
Yeah, so as you pointed out, in many cases with prices as low as in the $60 to $75 range, and certainly ranging up modestly and affordably, but not too out of control. A lot of these devices are available to anyone that might be listening anywhere. And certainly you can see for the investment of $75 or $150 or even a few hundred dollars versus the cost of just one trip to the emergency room or a visit by the ambulance and emergency responders, it makes it all worthwhile. Ron, in the last minute or two that we have with you, I just wanted to come back around to where we started with the CES, the Consumer Electronics Show. Can you give us a hint as to what the newest and most exciting thing that you're seeing in development and that's being rolled out either in prototype or for general use at CES, most recently?
Well, we're seeing more and more devices that are used for tracking, using GPS technology for actually tracking individuals. And mm-hmm. one of the issues that's extremely important is to have a device that's not too large and it's inconspicuous. So a wrist-worn device that looks very sleek and not too large in size, I think, is going to be key. And I know that they're developing devices that are becoming smaller and smaller that are very efficient. These devices are particularly important with the there's a growing number of individuals with dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Wandering is a major issue, especially with autistic children. So to have very efficient devices that can be slender in size and yet remain efficient are very important, and we're going to see them come on the market more and more. They also have, of the current devices we do use, they also have a feature called a geofence, which allows for the loved one to be notified as soon as an individual leaves a certain geographic area, like, say, 100 feet perimeter around their home. As soon as they step from that perimeter, it sends a notification, and individuals can be tracked. Right now, we have devices like this that do this, and they can be tracked using either a cell phone or an iPad or personal computer.
Yeah, great.
But I think the key is to make these smaller, sleeker, and less conspicuous.
Excellent.
So that's what we're looking forward to.
Great information during February, National Senior Independence Month, from our newest resource here on the award-winning For the People, Ron DeQuilla, RN, a frontline trauma responder, trauma center supervisor, and also co-founder of Assisted Living Technologies with their main offices on South Broad Street in Meriden. If you'd like to learn more about what Ron is doing and what they've got to offer, and maybe even go out and take a look at some of this technology that we talked about today, assistedlivingtechnologies.com is their website, or you can call 203-235-TECH. That's T-E-C-H on your keypad. Thank you, Ron. Great to meet you, and great information for our listeners this morning. Well, in our continuing efforts to not only introduce you to a wider array of our important state officials, but also in keeping in tune with our attention to storm readiness, not only facing and learning from the damage that was incurred during some severe winter storms over the past few years, but also looking toward the future, and in this case today, with an eye on housing-related issues. We're so pleased to welcome Connecticut Department of Housing Commissioner Yvonne Klein to the program with some incredible news, really the announcement of a $54 million federal grant for storm resiliency in Connecticut, which will improve shoreline infrastructure in the greater New Haven and Bridgeport areas. So, Commissioner Klein, great to meet you. Thank you for joining us on the program.
Oh, happy to be here.
So, go ahead.
It's very exciting, as you said, that receiving this $54 million grant from HUD, it really allows us to further forward our efforts in making Connecticut a more resilient state.
Yeah.
And clearly, we're still in the midst of our Sandy rehabilitation with our folks along the shoreline.
Mm-hmm.
But what this helps certainly helps with, as you're aware, is that it by making us more resilient, we're not going to have to keep going back and rebuilding and rebuilding.
Yeah.
This
is
an opportunity for us to put people in a safer, to allow for people being safer during a storm.
Yeah. Well, before we drill into some of the specifics and details and projects that will roll out as a result of this grant, I wanted to back up just a little bit and broaden our focus. Just for the purpose of folks that are listening, we've had Department of Housing spokespeople on before talking about specific programs to help people get into housing, to protect their mortgages or get them some relief if they're having problems with mortgages in recent years, but we never got to talk to you. Could you just give folks a little thumbnail sketch of what the Department of Housing's kind of great responsibilities are on behalf of the taxpayers?
Well, the responsibilities of the department are broad. Within the department, we address issues having to do with preventing and ending homelessness through developing rental housing, to providing housing subsidies, to home ownership opportunities. Our focus is to provide affordable housing for folks all along the income spectrum across the state of Connecticut. So to date, we have we've got 11,000 units of housing, whether they've been completed or have funding committed to them over the last 5 years. So from 2011 to 2015, we've completed over 7,500 units of affordable housing across the state. And together with CHAFA, we have invested $1 billion in affordable housing across the state of Connecticut, which is stark contrast to actually what's happened over the last 25 years.
Mm. Also, the face of affordable housing and what it really is in communities has changed drastically from a quarter century ago.
Well, it has. And I think when we look back at what affordable housing was, people have a vision of a big box and in some part of town. And the face of affordable housing today is scattered site units, mixed income developments, mixed use, mixed income developments across the state, in downtowns, in small village or suburban areas. So very different physically than what it was in years past. And, you know, actually, we were just reflecting on this the other day. I would say this transformation has happened over the last 15, 12 years, where affordable housing, if a newly built or a development built within the past 10 years, you will drive by and you can't tell the difference between a market rate unit or an affordable unit in the same inside the unit itself. And then, of course, the folks who need affordable housing. And, you know, what we typically say as a thumbnail, we use the HUD definition of housing that's affordable,
mm-hmm.
that you shouldn't be paying more than 30% of your income on housing. When that happens, you can't afford other things. So that's the metric that we use, and, of course, by income as well. So we've been very fortunate to have funding committed by the governor and by the state legislature. And that's state funding that we haven't seen in about 25 years so that we could build affordable housing across the state.
Sure. And I guess the cost of housing should not put you at risk for losing your housing, which is an important point that you make, which is you know, critical here. That's when folks are trying to keep all the plates in the air, economically speaking, a lot of advantages happening, and as you point out, integrating into neighborhoods without any real distinction whatsoever from the outside looking in, but certainly imbuing a lot of these owners with the ability to jump right in, you know, getting involved in neighborhoods and communities, you know, keeping up their properties with great pride, and really making new friends and new lives.
Well, yes, and also what we've learned, and having been a former first selectman, what we do know is that there are individuals and families that live in our communities who are having a tough time struggling. So there are folks already in our communities, not necessarily new folks who may be moving into our communities, and our workforce within our communities.
Mm. Right.
So who have to drive an hour to work every day or longer. And if there's a snowstorm, they can't, and some folks who have critical jobs may not get to the community in which they work. So there are so many folks who are in, and different kinds of folks who are in need of affordable housing. So we're making great progress from what we've seen in the past. And it's certainly an opportunity, as you mentioned, for folks to come into communities and really build a life rather than holding on to that old life of I'm paying 50% of my income on my rent and I can't go to the doctor, I can't go to the dentist, I you know, I can't make ends meet any other way.
Yeah, really important. Folks, if you're just tuning in, we're with Connecticut Department of Housing Commissioner Yvonne Klein, and with exciting news to switch gears to right now, as we said in the introduction, and Commissioner Klein began to explain, Connecticut was recently the recipient of a $54 million grant to be used to improve shoreline infrastructure, increase resiliency to combat future weather events, and ultimately to better ensure the safety of folks living in the greater New Haven and Bridgeport areas. So, Commissioner Klein, I guess in respect to this grant, the first thing is that it was being touted as being, if not highly unique, somewhat unusual, not only for this type of grant to go to this type of project, but also the amount of it. Is that right?
Well, I think the unique aspect of this is that we were focused on making connections to transit and making connections among neighborhoods. So that was the unique focus, I think, of this particular application.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, where the funding is going, well, we do have a very broad, you know, we don't have the details yet. We'll be actually on a call with HUD next week to talk a little bit more about the details of the funding. But for our purposes here, and I think for the public's purposes, it's focused on Bridgeport and New Haven and Fairfield counties. So the exciting opportunity that we have for New Haven and Fairfield counties are the opportunity to develop new guidelines that are floodplain design guidelines and using cutting-edge flood mitigation technologies. So it'll be something different than what we've done in the past and something certainly more current and forward-looking. So we look forward to getting going on that piece of the work. And then for New Haven, again, in Fairfield counties, we have the Connecticut Connections Coastal Resilience Plan. So that is actually working on an existing or forwarding an existing planning effort to allow more communities in New Haven and Fairfield counties with the goals that include providing accessible, downscaled, inland and coastal flooding information. And this way, this certainly helps the inland and coastal municipalities to plan for and understand what they need to be doing to become, you know, more resilient.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the efforts that will be focused in Bridgeport over in the South End, which is the bulk of the funding for Bridgeport, will be going to the South End East Resilience Network. And that does include the elevation of University Avenue.
Mm.
So that's something that, you know, when we talk about the safety of folks, you know, our ability to get folks out of a dangerous situation, and of course, you know, before that, preventing anything. So yeah. The elevation of University Avenue is really critical.
Oh, sure. I worked in Bridgeport.
Right.
I know that for a while. I know that stretch, and even with moderate high tides, occasionally it's impassable.
Well, yes, and it's in a 100-year floodplain, and actually, if you grade a map and you look at it, there's a lot of blue over in this area.
Yep.
So, you know, so clearly, so for the folks who live there, this is obviously critical, but also thinking ahead to any type of new development that could occur down in the South End.
Mm-hmm.
This would only help, you know, again, we constantly, you know, I always feel like, you know, we've got one eye in the present and then the other eye on the future. Which is clearly important to be doing and looking ahead at.
Hmm.
So, again, this allows us to protect the folks who are already there and then also to allow development into this area without any or with minimal risk, so which is great.
Yeah, I think the other awesome thing is, you know, you're looking at about 34.4 million for the resiliency network, but at the same time, for the relatively nominal $350,000, you're doing that critical companion component, the infrastructure study.
Correct. And actually, I was just going to talk about that, and so I'm glad that you highlighted that infrastructure study in that way, because again, you know, as most folks may be aware of Connecticut's use of microgrids. So again, furthering those opportunities to use microgrids in that area and others and expanding this. So once again, looking at alternative energy sources so that energy supply isn't disrupted during emergencies.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're doing here in Bridgeport, again, in with anything we do in the state, we have an eye on replication and the ability to replicate what we're doing elsewhere with success.
Mm-hmm.
And the last piece of the funding for Bridgeport is $1 million for the Community Design Center. So this is something that had come up a number of times, and this would just simply serve as an anchor in the South End.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an exciting opportunity for the state. The funding, you know, some folks have asked, how does this all mechanically work? Funding comes to the state, to the Department of Housing, and then we would work with folks to get these projects going in mm-hmm. Bridgeport and then in Fairfield and New Haven counties. So, yes.
I guess in the last minute or two that I have with you, Commissioner Klein, then is for the folks listening in Waterbury and Torrington, Meriden, and Hartford, when they say, "Oh, more money to Fairfield County," arguably the communities who need it least, just on face of the you know the value and economic base in Fairfield County. But I'd like you to just take a moment to explain to folks in the rest of the state why this investment is so critically important and concentrated in the Southwest.
Well, clearly, you know, and obviously our shoreline, which continues to need to be protected, it certainly affects the whole state of Connecticut. But I would like to point out that Bridgeport is one of the poorest municipalities. And when HUD invests, and that's where HUD looks to make their investments to improve the quality of life in some of the poorest municipalities. And once again, New Haven and Fairfield County, that's where our shoreline is. That's the shoreline that needs to be protected. And our shoreline across the state. And I think, again, we just need to take a broader look here. When we can learn lessons here and replicate that in other communities. So, you know, if the shoreline or in another part of the state, certainly we would be doing these same projects in that other side of the state. So I certainly understand the concern, but I would also like to add that we have, as a Department of Housing, we have been investing in other municipalities across the state.
Oh, of course.
So, but with specifically regarding this funding and dealing with the floodplain, this is where the floodplain is, and certainly federal funding is needed to address these big issues because we don't have the funding as a state to do it, and we certainly, individual municipalities, don't have the funding to address these issues on their own.
Great. Well, a great meeting and first conversation with you, Commissioner Klein. I hope it is far from our last, because of all the great work that you're doing and the manner in which you explain it so well to folks that are listening. If you've recently tuned in, folks, Connecticut was one of a few states that received grants from the National Disaster Resiliency Competition, which was a competitive funding round offered by HUD to ensure states are prepared for future weather events. Connecticut captured $54 million for projects in Fairfield County, Bridgeport, and the greater New Haven areas. Our guest this morning has been Connecticut Department of Housing Commissioner Yvonne Klein. Yvonne, great to meet you, and thank you so much for your time this morning and explaining all this important and great news. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and don't necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.vocat, V as in Victor, O-K-E-T, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for another installment of the award-winning For the People, or listen to this and other For the People podcasts under the podcast tab on our station's website or on iTunes. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.